Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the ruling in Texas that struck down parts of a very restrictive abortion law that Texas Senator Wendy Davis challenged with her 13-hour filibuster. Carolyn Jones, who covers women's reproductive health for the Texas Observer, joins us to discuss what abortion restrictions survived the federal judge's ruling that will go into effect Tuesday. Then we will speak with Dennis Kelleher, the president and CEO of Better Markets, Inc., a Washington, D.C. nonprofit that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. We will discuss the $13 billion settlement J.P. Morgan has agreed to pay and the apparent scapegoating of a minor official with Countrywide Savings who appears to be taking the fall for the housing market crash that is yet to see any major Wall Street players taking a perp walk or doing time for the massive crimes that led to the 2008 Wall Street crash. Then finally, we'll speak with behavioral economist John List about his new book, The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives in the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. We will discuss fieldwork he has done that combines economics with anthropology and comes up with surprising results on why women earn less, why people discriminate, what is behind inner-city violence and the gap between rich and poor students, and what can be done to improve public education. And joining us now is Caroline Jones, who is a freelance writer and journalist based in Austin, Texas, who covers women's reproductive health care for the Texas Observer. She also contributes to the UK Guardian, Glamour, Women's E-News, Time.com, and Al Jazeera. Welcome to Background Briefing, Caroline Jones.
Thanks, Ian.
And on Monday, a federal judge in Texas blocked an important part of the state's restrictive new abortion laws that Senator Wendy Davis did her 13-hour filibuster to stop going into effect. Let's begin then with Judge Lee Yackel of the U.S. District Court in Austin's ruling that said that there was no medical purpose of particularly for the part that was struck down that would have forced the closure of at least one-third of the state's 36 abortion clinics.
Yes, that's right. He struck down the admitting privileges provision, which was a requirement that all abortion clinics in Texas have admitting privileges to a hospital within 30 miles of them. Now, as the plaintiffs in the case, the plaintiffs were the American Civil Liberties Union, the Center for Reproductive Rights, and a number of Planned Parenthood affiliates. As they argued to the judge, this particular provision is not only does it not improve patient safety, but it's also bureaucratically impossible to achieve because a number of hospitals will not grant admitting privileges to abortion providers for ideological reasons and also for more practical reasons. They only grant admitting privileges to people who have a certain number of admissions into their hospital. And abortion is actually very safe in the U.S. Very few women have abortion complications, and a very, very small percentage end up in hospital as a result of these complications. So the abortion providers would not be able to reach that threshold. There is another reason that they couldn't grant the admitting privileges is some hospitals only grant privileges to doctors who actually live in the area, but as is the case in many abortion clinics across the U.S., many abortion doctors are peripatetic. They actually travel from one city to another. Some travel from one state to another to provide abortions. So it would just be impossible for them to be given privileges because they are not locally resident. Now, the plaintiffs successfully argued to the judge in the Western District Court that it would be so difficult for many of these clinics to grant to gain these admitting privileges and therefore abide by this law that up to a third of them would close and up to 22,000 women would lose access to abortion services. And this is of constitutional interest to the court in the sense that the state is not allowed to make put such an undue burden on women's ability to access abortion that she can no longer access it. So what Judge Yackel found in this particular case was, yes, these privileges, if they force these clinics to close, women would struggle, and particularly in the western part of Texas, to access abortion. This classifies as an undue burden, therefore it's unconstitutional.
And Texas Governor Perry, in responding to the decision, he said, "We will continue fighting to implement the laws passed by the duly elected officials of our state, laws that reflect the will and values of Texans." Now, I'd like to get into what survived the ruling, because Cecile Richards, the president of Planned Parenthood, is certainly upset about what survived. But let's just talk a little bit about Perry. And, of course, he and Wendy Davis became the protagonists and antagonists in this struggle to get this bill passed. I remember covering it at the time, and I learned that Governor Perry's own sister is a lobbyist for the for a group of hospitals that would have benefited from this ruling, which would force these clinics to close, and therefore they'd have to go to these other clinics, because the part that was struck down simply was that these clinic owners couldn't meet the admitting privilege requirement. And so she and her clients were well-placed to benefit from her brother's law, weren't they?
That's right. This is actually the bill, that the law that we're talking about has four parts to it. We just talked about the first one, which was the admitting privileges. Another large part of it is the bit that could, you know, theoretically benefit Governor Perry's sister, is the rule that all abortion clinics have to upgrade their facilities in line with ambulatory surgical care centers. Now, this law, this provision only goes into effect next September, so it's not even sort of on the cards yet for any of the clinics. But Governor Perry's sister, Miller Perry Jones, is a lobbyist for a group of ambulatory surgical care centers. So one could argue that if these clinics were forced to shut because they simply couldn't afford to upgrade their facilities, her constituents are well placed to continue to provide abortion services because they've, you know, already got all the expensive equipment and building facilities in place.
Now, did that ruling survive?
That ruling was not part of the judgment. There were only actually two parts of the, there were only two provisions of the law being challenged. The first was the admitting privileges, which the judge struck down as unconstitutional. But the second part of the bill that was being challenged was a restriction on medication abortions. Now, just to clarify, there are two types of abortions that a woman can access. The first is a surgical abortion, and the second is a medication one, where she takes a series of drugs in order to induce the abortion. And about 40% of women in the U.S. choose the medication abortions. It's an option you can have in the early stages of pregnancy. This bill was going to is restricting the way that you can access, the way that those medication abortions are provided. So what the bill requires is that abortion clinics follow the FDA protocol, which is outdated. It requires a much stronger dosage than what clinics currently provide. It also requires an extra in-person visit with the clinic. And there is actually clinics across the U.S. do not follow the FDA protocol. They follow something called the evidence-based protocol. And it's very normal across the U.S. to do this. There's much more evidence that it's safer for women. The dosage is much lower, and it's cheaper as well for women to access. However, the second provision of this bill was requiring abortion clinics to go back and use this outdated protocol based on the FDA. And in a bit of a surprise move today, the judge ruled that even though clinics following the FDA protocol was going to be burdensome for women, inconvenient, and more expensive, it wasn't unconstitutionally burdensome. So he didn't overturn it. So as of tomorrow, the FDA protocol goes into effect. But the bit that sort of surprised everyone, there was a sort of a flurry of confusion when the ruling first came out, there is one exception. And that is for women for whom it is not medically appropriate to have a surgical abortion. They can still have this medication abortion under the old regime, under the old protocol, but it's up to the physician to decide whether she qualifies or not. So it leaves a number of questions now for the abortion physician. Is it going to be legal for me to offer a medication abortion to this woman? If I don't, you know, if there's no clarification on what is legal, will I be sued if I do the wrong thing? So it does leave a number of questions there. But nonetheless, abortion rights providers are disappointed with Judge Yackel's decision in that regard to continue with the FDA protocol, which is much more restrictive. And Ian, there is another part of the bill as well, which is the a ban on abortions at 20 weeks. This was not part of the court case, and so this is going into effect tomorrow. So just to recap, what becomes law in Texas tomorrow is a ban on abortion after 20 weeks of gestation, and medication abortions for all women except for those for whom it's not medically appropriate to have a surgical abortion. Next September, it will also be law that they have to upgrade, make costly upgrades in line with ambulatory surgical care centers. and currently blocked, as I said, is the admitting privileges bit, which, as of about an hour ago, the state has appealed Judge Yackel's decision up to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is notoriously conservative. So they're hoping that the Fifth Circuit will rule in their favor and bring admitting privileges back into Texas law.
And, of course, the part that survived is the part that's going to benefit Rick Perry's sister.
I mean, that has been argued that we'd have to see how that
sure.
plays out.
Right.
That's certainly been part of the debate.
Right. So, again, I'm speaking with Carolyn Jones, who's a freelance writer and journalist based in Austin, who covers women's reproductive health care for the Texas Observer. She also contributes to the UK Guardian, Glamour, Women's E-News, Time.com, and Al Jazeera. And, of course, the judge did say at the end of the day these issues are going to be decided definitively by not by this court, but by either the circuit or the Supreme Court of the United States. And that, I guess he's referring particularly to the 20-week ban, right? That's in conflict with Roe v. Wade, isn't it?
Well, not necessarily. The 20-week ban has not, as I said, has not been challenged by plaintiffs in Texas. So at present, it will not likely go up to the Supreme Court unless someone else decides to challenge it. But the admitting privileges provision or the medication abortions could make it up to the Supreme Court, depending on how the various lower courts rule.
Well, but I thought that in most other states it was, what, 26 weeks? I mean, why 20 weeks? What is the – I mean, so many of these abortion restrictions have little to do with women's health, but they're incremental ways to make abortion more and more difficult. And the motives, they couch them in terms of,
yes.
of where we're concerned about women's health. But it's very clear that their real agenda is to make abortions next to impossible to get. So I want to get some clarity on that, if you don't mind.
That's right, and that's a good question. The reason that they introduced the 20-week ban in Texas is based, they call it the Preborn Pain Act. And the bill authors cited research to say that the fetus has sufficient neural connections at 20 weeks gestation to feel pain. Now, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, as well as a number of other medical providers, challenged those studies. They say, in fact, the fetal brain is not sufficiently developed to feel pain until about 29 weeks of gestation. But nonetheless, in various conservative state legislatures where this 20-week ban has been passed, it's been passed on the basis of studies that say fetuses can feel pain much earlier. No one has yet challenged that up to the Supreme Court, but and I'm certain I'm not a constitutional scholar, so I wouldn't want to sort of make any broad statements about that. But certainly, the Constitution, as it's currently written, it allows abortion up until the stage of viability. And viability is currently somewhere around 25, 26 weeks. And viability means that the fetus can survive outside the womb. So certainly a 20-week ban, or even in some states a 12-week ban or a 6-week ban, is unconstitutional in that the fetus is not yet viable. But what that would take in order for it to be challenged is for one of the states to actually raise that all the way up to the Supreme Court. And there's a strategic decision to be made there because of the way that the Supreme Court is currently constituted. It depends, really, do they want Roe v. versus Wade overturned completely? Anti-abortion activists do, so I think they're very keen to have something like this 20-week ban brought up to the Supreme Court. Abortion right activists would be concerned to bring that up to the Supreme Court in case it's found that the Supreme Court rules that viability is actually much earlier, and that will then reduce access for women all across the United States. So there's definitely a strategic decision being made in different states, but in Texas, they made the decision not to challenge the 20-week ban.
So when Cecile Richards, the daughter of the former governor of Texas, who's the president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, says that while this ruling protects access to safe and legal abortion for women in many parts of the state, it puts ideology over science by banning a safe method of abortion for many women. So what's she referring to there?
She's referring to the medication abortions that we were talking about earlier, which is the using that off-label, or sorry, I was calling it an evidence-based protocol we talked about earlier, that, as I say, all abortion clinics and across the world use this protocol. So what Cecile Richards is referring to is the fact that this is considered the safe way to provide medication abortions, and the fact that Judge Yackel has ruled that this is not, that is, this is not legal in Texas, removes the option of many women to have medication abortions as a result. And this has proven to be safe. As I said, 40% of women in Texas choose medication abortions. Complication rates are extremely low, and there are often minor complications like infections that can be treated. So this is what she's referring to, is the fact that, you know, it's safe, but it's being removed from these women now.
Well, just in closing, though, Carolyn Jones, just to get a broad picture here, this sort of seems like a mixed win and loss, if you will. And you also said that the appeal is going to go to the Fifth Circuit, which is a very conservative court. So whatever people in Texas in support of women's reproductive rights think is a victory, that may be overturned. That may be lost there. Is that right?
That's right, yes. It's certainly it's a partial victory today for abortion rights activists, and it also, it may be a hollow one if it gets up to the Fifth Circuit and if the Fifth Circuit rules in favor of the state, which many observers do expect them to do, because, as I say, they're conservative. And then it's up to the abortion rights activists if the ball's back in their court. If the Fifth Circuit decides to overturn Judge Yackel's ruling, do the abortion rights activists then ask for the Supreme Court to look at it and risk it becoming a constitutional question? That's a very difficult question for them to make, very difficult decision for them to make.
And just in closing, the state senator, Wendy Davis, who's made the 13-hour filibuster that got her national attention, she's running for governor. Does she have a chance in this apparently very conservative state? You know, I'm not sure how much it's turned into Ted Cruz land. But,
well, now that is the million-dollar question, Ian. I'm sure everyone would like to know, including the Davis campaign. They certainly believe that she has a winning chance. But as you say, it is Ted Cruz land. I mean, in 2012, 57% of Texas voted for Ted Cruz for senator, 57% voted for Romney. So it is a very conservative state. Senator Wendy Davis obviously has the vote of women's health advocates in Texas. That's definitely in the bag. But her challenge now is to expand her support amongst other groups as well. And that's, you know, what she's doing now is she's launched her campaign. Greg Abbott has a strong tailwind behind him. He's the attorney general who is running for governor and is the expected winner. But Wendy Davis certainly has the national celebrity behind her, and a great groundswell of support from groups that might not have supported her before, but, you know, after what happened during the summer, would certainly, you know, give her their vote. But as I say, early days to know yet.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Carolyn Jones.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Carolyn Jones, who's a freelance writer and journalist based in Austin, who covers women's reproductive health care for the Texas Observer. She also contributes to the UK Guardian, Glamour, Women's E-News, Time.com, and Al Jazeera. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about a single mother being scapegoated for the Wall Street crash.
It has always been around. It will always have a niche. But they'll make it a privilege, not a right, accessible only to the rich. Hey, pro-lifers need to dig themselves, because life don't stop after birth. And for a child born to the unprepared, it might even just get worse. The situation would surely change if they were to find themselves in it. Supporters of the H-bomb and firebombing clinics.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound.
A mark, a yen,
a buck, or a pound. Is all that makes the world go round, that clinking, clanking sound. That makes the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dennis Kelleher, who is the President and Chief Executive Officer of Better Markets, Inc., a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. Better Markets is a Wall Street watchdog that has been referred to as a persistent thorn in the side of Wall Street. And Dennis has held several senior staff positions in the United States Senate, most recently as Chief Counsel and Senior Leadership Advisor to the Chairman of the Senate Democratic Party Policy Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dennis Kelleher.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Very well. And while J.P. Morgan's Jamie Dimon apparently has agreed to a $13 billion settlement, 5 years after the housing bust, Rebecca S. Mayrone, a mid-level executive at the Bank of America's Countrywide Mortgage Unit, is being held liable by a federal grand jury for having saddled Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac with mortgage losses of over $1 billion. And you were quoted in a New York Times article recently about this, that you think it's just indefensible that prosecutors are going after the Rebeccas of this world. There was systemic fraud at these banks, and prosecutors are going after the minnows and not the whales. So is Rebecca Mayrone a minnow and Jamie Dimon a whale?
Well, there's no question Jamie Dimon's a whale, and there's no question that J.P. Morgan Chase, his bank, is a whale. It's the largest bank in the world, more than $2 trillion in assets, 250,000 employees across the globe. And if you read its own disclosure in its latest quarterly corporate filing, the so-called 10-Q, you'll see 10 single-space pages on just litigation facing the corporation, ranging from crimes allegedly committed in Italy, all the way to China, and a wide swath of illegality, wrongdoing, and possible criminality from coast to coast of the United States.
Well, it seems that a lot of these companies are putting aside a lot of money, aren't they? For example, Bank of America, which, of course, assumed Countrywide Financial and Merrill Lynch, they've taken more than $40 billion in expenses relating to mortgage securities. And J.P. Morgan, apparently, since 2010, have set aside $28 billion.
Well, that's true. They are putting aside money to start paying out on some of these wrongdoings that they did years ago, although, frankly, the reporting on J.P. Morgan is that many of these are not that long ago. And let's remember that the London whale trade, where the losses were over $6 billion directly and about $30 billion in market cap losses for shareholders, were just about 18 months ago. But the problem is not to let big numbers blind people to the reality. The $13 billion settlement that's being reported, negotiated between J.P. Morgan Chase and the Department of Justice is a big number and looks like a big number, but is not such a big number compared to the damage and illegality and wrongdoing that was done by the bank. And it's also not such a big number if you look at actually what it's made up of, and it's not even all cash. And we've put out a fact sheet on this. If people go to our website at www.bettamarkets.com, you'll find on our homepage a fact sheet that kind of details that $13 billion isn't really $13 billion. And, oh, by the way, the economic damage or the illegality done by J.P. Morgan Chase is many, many multiples of that. It may be nothing more than pennies or dimes on the dollar. We don't know yet. But the numbers should not eclipse egregious widespread wrongdoing and possible criminality by many, many individuals, never mind the bank. And the individuals, of course, are all getting off unless you're the Rebecca of the world.
Well, just in terms of Rebecca Mayrone, she's a 46-year-old single mother who regularly worked a 12-hour day and was on the road 1 week out of every month. And she apparently sneaked out to take care of her 14-year-old daughter to Girl Scout events and take her 19-year-old son to karate tournaments. And contrast the fact that she is going to jail, whereas she received apparently $1.2 million in bonuses. And that same year, Angelo Mozzillo, the head of Countrywide, he cashed in $121.5 million in stock sales on top of his $22 million in compensation. And then 3 years later, without admitting any guilt, Mozzillo paid a fine of $67.5 million to settle fraud charges with the Securities and Exchange Commission, and $20 million of which was paid by Countrywide as a part of its contractual agreement. And then in 2011, prosecutors abandoned their investigation of Mr. Mozzillo. So they're going after this mid-level executive at Bank of America's Countrywide Mortgage Unit, and he's got off scot-free. It really does. I don't know. It's just really upsetting that.
Well, I'll tell you, it should upset everybody in America who believes in justice, because there's supposed to be one standard of law in the country. There's not supposed to be one for the wealthy and well-connected of Wall Street, and then one standard of justice for the rest of America. Main Street gets the book thrown at it, and Wall Street gets coddled. And then, of course, they then claim they're being treated unfairly, and they need our sympathy. And you put it just right, which is Countrywide CEO Mozilla collected just about pocketed almost $150 million in 2007 alone. Now, Rebecca Marone may well be guilty and may well deserve to have been found liable. She's not going to jail. It was a civil trial. But she may have done wrongdoing, and she should be held to account for that. But so shouldn't everybody else. I assure you, a junior person like Rebecca Marone was not designing these programs, was not primarily profiting from them, certainly not compared to all her colleagues. And these programs and the profits from these programs flowed to dozens and hundreds of other people much more senior than her. And the failure of the Department of Justice and the SEC or anybody else to go after the senior individuals who actually profited the most from these activities and were involved up to their necks, at least in a requirement to supervise them, and not one of them have been held to account by this so-called Department of Justice or the SEC, that's a despicable dereliction of duty.
Again, I'm speaking with Dennis Kelleher, the President and Chief Executive Officer of Better Markets, Inc., a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. Better Markets is a Wall Street watchdog that has been referred to as a persistent thorn in the side of Wall Street, and Dennis has held several senior staff positions with the U.S. Senate, most recently as Chief Counsel and Senior Leadership Advisor to the Chairman of the Senate Democratic Policy Committee. And I'm sure, Dennis, you saw the very good Frontline special that was done on Wall Street and why nobody's gone to jail. And a lot of the focus was on the Deputy Attorney General, who really did not equip himself very well in the Frontline documentary. And he subsequently moved from the Justice Department to Wall Street. But what about his boss? I mean, his boss... The Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, apparently had private meetings with Jamie Dimon when he was under scrutiny. So is the problem at the Justice Department?
Well, I think the Justice Department has been a key part of the problem during this entire administration. And I think history is going to judge Attorney General Holder incredibly harshly, not only for his complete and utter failure to direct the appropriate resources and people at the Department of Justice to investigate the Wall Street crash. And let's remember, it was the worst crash since 1929, and it has delivered this country the worst economy since the Great Depression. And for them not to be able to find one individual anywhere on Wall Street that might have broken the law criminally is an abdication of duty. And you referred to the Frontline show. It's called The Untouchables, and people should watch it. It's award-winning and spectacularly well done. And it did have Lanny Brewer, who was the head of the criminal division, sweating when asked questions about how he could not find anyone who committed a crime. And, of course, he came from a big law firm where he defended white-collar criminals and or people who are alleged to do wrongdoing, and he went right back there through the revolving door. Now, and yet, Attorney General Holder is left, and it's reported that Attorney General Holder was in a conference room with his senior people going to be walking into a press conference to announce a lawsuit to be filed against J.P. Morgan Chase. And into that conference room, Jamie Dimon called and then offered substantial amounts of money to the Attorney General and Department of Justice to settle a bunch of lawsuits to prevent them from filing the lawsuit. This reported several weeks ago. And since then, it's been reported there are these private backroom negotiations between the most powerful banker in America, who heads the biggest bank in America, with the Attorney General of the United States himself and his senior people. And it's expected that soon, in the next few days, weeks, they're going to come out and announce the big deal they negotiated and cut behind closed doors. But how many people in the United States get to call the Attorney General, stop a press conference, prevent a lawsuit from being filed, and then negotiate a deal behind closed doors, which, and again, if you go to our website at bettermarkets.com, we've detailed this, a deal that's starting to look like an awfully nice sweetheart deal, even though it appears to be $13 billion. That's a double standard of justice that's built on crony capitalism, special access, undue influence, and connections that should not be justifiable in the United States, where the Department of Justice is supposed to apply the law without fear or favor.
And Dennis Kelleher, again, the president and chief executive officer of Better Markets, Inc., a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. Are you suggesting that this $13 billion thing may be less than meets the eye, given J.P. Morgan's $2.4 trillion in assets?
The problem is we don't know, but it appears that J.P. Morgan Chase's liability here could range somewhere between $100 and $200 billion. Now, we don't know because it hasn't been disclosed which investigations, which lawsuits may be settled or for how much. But if you settle something for $13 billion and you had $200 billion of liability, that starts to look like a pretty sweet deal if you're J.P. Morgan Chase. And one of the things that we're insisting on is that if this comes to a deal and they announce it, they have to, and they should be required to, disclose with particularity every part of every lawsuit and allegation that's being settled and the amount of possible liability and what it's being settled for, so the American people can see for themselves that this wasn't a backroom sweetheart deal cut between the top so-called law enforcement officer of the United States and the richest, most powerful banker of the United States. And if that isn't done, if the details aren't provided and people can't judge for themselves, then we're going to know what the verdict really should be on these two people.
Well, I recall that Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan, is a close friend of Bill Clinton's. And, of course, Bill Clinton took the disastrous advice of his Secretary of the Treasury, who was a Wall Streeter, and they got rid of the Glass-Steagall Act that had existed since the Great Depression. And suddenly, shortly thereafter, we had this disastrous meltdown on Wall Street. And listening to you, Dennis, I'm wondering whether is this a class thing? Have we become a class society where billionaires are sort of above the law and that they kind of have access at the highest levels and interact in the great political and social salons of the country?
Well, it's certainly starting to look that way. If you go to fundamentals, what happened here is we have the richest industry in the history of the world. And I don't think it's an overstatement that many of these people are pocketing amounts of money that would make the pharaohs of Egypt envious by comparison. And you have them amassing economic power to the tune that they want to protect it. And what they do is they then use it to purchase political power that enables them to amass more economic power. And it becomes a corrosive crony capitalism between the top of the economic class, largely located on Wall Street, and the political class. And you end up with this double standard of justice. And the other thing that's important to mention, both on the $13 billion possible settlement and otherwise, Ian, is that this is only a fine to the bank. It gets to use other people's money to pay it. The bank uses today's shareholders' money. And what they're really doing is buying a get-out-of-jail-free card for all their executives. There's no discussion in any of the reporting on the possible settlement that any specific individual will even be charged with a civil liability of any type. Well, I have news for Attorney General Holder. Banks don't break laws. People do. And without individual accountability, you don't just risk more crime. You incentivize, reward, and guarantee more crime. And that's as true on the Main Street street corner as it is on Wall Street, which has been on a crime spree for a decade, and they've done nothing about it.
Well, just to return to Rebecca Marone, the mid-level executive at the Bank of America's Countrywide Mortgage, who seems to be taking the fall here. You say she's not going to jail, but she's going to pay a price. And you're just pointing out that the $13 billion price that Jamie Dimon pays actually doesn't come out of his pocket. But what I thought was sort of touching in a way about Rebecca Marone was that after this whole disaster happened, she took a job with Bank of America where she spent her time working with people whose mortgages are under water, trying to literally redeem herself and redeem, her company and her bank for these liar's loans and these fraudulent lending as best she could. I don't see that similar redemption happening on Wall Street. They seem just to be, the banks are bigger than ever in terms of too big to fail. And they're buying more and more of our politics and eviscerating Dodd-Frank. And rather than show redemption and humility, they seem to be showing arrogance and disdain.
You know, you put your finger on it because we at Better Markets fight for financial reform and fight to rein in Wall Street and protect Main Street. And one of the big questions that we often ask, I've actually written about it, is where are the statesmen? In years past and decades past, one of the great things about this country is that times of crisis or turmoil, individuals have stood up and acted against interest and did what's right, even when it cost them. And that, frankly, has been a big part of the ethos, not just of the country, but of the business elite in this country. And one of the shocking things about this crisis is there hasn't been a single financial statesman. There hasn't been a single person in a position of responsibility on Wall Street to stand up, own up to what they did, accept what they did, and say, for the better of the country, we're going to do better, and this is what we're going to change. And so what you have is the exact opposite, which is you have hubris and arrogance run amok. That's how 3 years after, and even more, the financial crisis in 2008, what is J.P. Morgan Chase doing betting $150 billion of depositors' money in 2012, 4 years after the crisis, in a complex high-risk derivatives bet that had a notional amount of $1 trillion? That's what's referred to in the paper as the London Whale bet that lost $6 billion plus a lot more of shareholders' market cap. That's 4 years after the crisis. Not only haven't they learned the lesson, they have denied the facts, they have rewarded themselves with additional historic bonuses, and then they've been arrogant about it. And what do they get as a punishment? They get the Attorney General of the United States, who says those too-big-to-fail banks, they're too big to enforce the law against them. And then he tries to walk that back, but now it looks like he's going to cut a deal that's going to make J.P. Morgan Chase's shareholders quite happy, because when it was leaked that there was a possible $13 billion deal, the stock didn't move at all. Well, and that tells you that it's not going to hurt J.P. Morgan Chase at all. And right. That means it's one sweetheart deal.
Well, Dennis Kelleher, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Dennis Kelleher, the President and Chief Executive Officer of Better Markets, Inc., a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. Better Markets is a Wall Street watchdog and has been referred to as a persistent thorn in the side of Wall Street. Dennis has held several senior staff positions in the United States Senate, most recently as the Chief Counsel and Senior Leadership Advisor to the Chairman of the Senate Democratic Policy Committee. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the Y-axis, hidden motives in the undiscovered economics of everyday life. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John List, a professor of economics and chairman of the Department of Economics at the University of Chicago. He's been a research associate at the National Bureau of Economics for more than a decade and served as senior economist on the President's Council of Economic Advisors for Environmental Resource Economics. He's also co-author of the new book just out, The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. Welcome to Background Briefing, John List.
Ian, thanks for having me.
And you're a behavioral economist, and you seem to have merged economics and anthropology here in the research for your new book, The Y-Axis. And in your book, you reveal, I'll just quickly read some of the things which individually are fairly earth-shattering, not to mention collectively. You reveal ways to close the gap between rich and poor students, to stop the violence plaguing inner-city schools, to decipher whether women are really less competitive than men, to correctly price products and services, and to discover the real reasons why people discriminate. So that's the ultimate Gordian knot there that you've untied. I mean, I'm very impressed.
Well, I appreciate that. In the end of the day, I'm just an economist. I like to go out into the real world. I like to use scientific tools, and I like to learn about what motivates people to behave as they do.
And, of course, economics in its foundation with Adam Smith, who was a social philosopher, was, of course, connected to everyday life, and it seems to have drifted off over the years, and more recently with the sort of numbers crunchers like Milton Friedman and the Ayn Rand incomprehensible acolyte on this Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan. So are you sort of bringing economics back to its more human roots?
You know, I think that's a good observation, Ian. When you look back at the fathers of economics, people like Adam Smith, you're exactly right. They would go out to a pin factory, and they would observe workers in their real environments, and they would try to figure out what's motivating those workers and what can we do to make those workers better off. And then economics went through a period, a very long period, where mathematical models began to rule the day. And I think my research begins to bring us back to the roots of economics, to not only look at behavioral economics, but to use approaches that are popular in anthropology and approaches that are popular in psychology to learn about exactly what does motivate people in their real environments.
And you went all around the country and all around the world, from the foothills of Kilimanjaro to California wineries, northern India to Chicago, of course, where you are. Now, since you went to the California wineries, and we're speaking to you from California, one of the things that you discovered, and we'll go through some of them, this is relatively trivial compared to some of the bigger questions that you answer here, but I was curious, since I like wine, that you discovered that a small vintner in California discovered that doubling the price of its Cabernet Sauvignon actually increased demand for the wine. Was the wine any good?
Yeah. It was excellent. You know, wine is a really interesting good. So, like you, I'm a wine connoisseur. But what's interesting about wine is that many times people look at the price of the wine and they infer the quality of the wine from that price. So when we talk to vineyards and folks that are actually retailing wine, what we ask them is we say, how did you determine how high to set the price for your wine? And very few of them have actually experimented with lowering or raising the price. So when we go in with our tools to figure out exactly whether they should be raising or lowering the price or keeping it the same, in many cases with wine, what we find is that if you raise price a little bit, in the case that you mentioned, we doubled price, you can actually not only make more money, but in some cases, you can actually sell more wine.
So in terms of the first couple of things I mentioned, and, you know, you deal with students and you say that some of your anthropological/economic experiments that are in your new book, The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life, that there are ways to close the gap between rich and poor students. We know that the student debt problem has exploded in the last few years, and that student debt is now greater than household debt in the United States. So this is something that I think a lot of our listeners are very, very concerned about. So what does your research find to reveal ways to close that gap?
So about 5 years ago, I became interested in education and how we can close the stubborn gap between white students and minority students. What you find is year after year, white students outperform minority students by quite a large gap, and it's really hard to get rid of that gap. Now, what we did is we went back to the roots of education, and we set up our own preschools here in Chicago, and we set up two preschools to look at exactly what we should be doing for kids ages 3, 4, and 5 to close the racial achievement gap. Now, 4 years later, here we are, and what we figured out is that within 3 months, now I'm talking about within 90 days, we can just about completely close the racial achievement gap by using the correct mix of what's called a parent academy, which is we directly teach the parent how to teach his or her child, and we also directly treat the child ourselves with, say, 3 or 4 hours every morning, Monday through Friday, with a curriculum that very importantly teaches kids what are called non-cognitive skills, or skills like patience or perseverance. What we find is that if you have the really good mix of a parent academy with a good curriculum where we teach kids, we can considerably close a racial achievement gap within 3 months.
Again, I'm speaking with John List, Professor of Economics and Chairman of the Department of Economics at the University of Chicago. He's been a research associate at the National Bureau of Economics and for more than a decade served as senior economist on the President's Council on Economic Advisors for Environmental Resource Economics. He is the co-author of the new book just out, The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. Now, Chicago, of course, is probably the most violent plague in a city, has the most violence plagued in a city of any place in America, and the bloodletting continues. And you have found ways to stop this violence?
Yeah, you're exactly right. When you look at the teen violence here in Chicago, it is it's very disturbing. We have kids, you know, when we first started the research, there was a Chicago Public Schools student shot nearly every day here in Chicago. So I began working with the chief executive officer from the Chicago Public Schools to think about ways to lower the teen gun violence that we observe here in Chicago. And when you take on a chore like that, your first job is you have to figure out which are the kids most at risk. So we took mounds and mounds of data from Chicago Public Schools, and we beat up those data to come up with a risk measure for each child in Chicago Public Schools. And we can detail now which kids are most likely to be victims of gun violence. And from there, we go in with interventions to try to help those kids, because many of those kids who are victims of gun violence also happen to be those kids who are doing the shooting themselves. So now we have gone in with an agency from Pennsylvania called YAP, and we have treated hundreds of kids to get them off the streets, get them involved in productive activities, and we have not only lowered the gun violence, but we have also importantly kept many of these kids in school, because when you look at the dropout rate, for every 100 of these kids that enters the ninth grade, you know, only about 45 of them end up making it out with a high school diploma. So our program is not only about stopping youth gun violence, but it's also about keeping kids in school so they can be productive members of society for decades to come. And we talk about that study in the book, The Y-Axis.
So, but you also point out in your book, The Y-Axis, that in spite of the fact that the United States spends far more on public education than most other developed countries, the high school dropout rate is higher than 50% in some places. So what do you attribute that to?
You know, we're funneling billions and billions of dollars into public education, yet we still haven't quite gotten it right. And I think the main reason why is because we have not executed or conducted field experiments in schools. So what we should be doing in our public schools is we should not only be using our schools to teach our kids, but we should be using our schools to teach ourselves what works and why. In the moment we begin to have that cultural revolution to use schools to teach ourselves, we will then begin to learn about what works and why, and we will be able to take on this education problem that we have all around the U.S. and defeat it and move the U.S. to the point where we really need to be. We need to be leaders of public education, not laggards. And we can do that if we use every school district as a laboratory of innovation. And each time we have a major project, that we treat it like a scientific experiment, then we can learn exactly what works and why, and we can turn around this education problem.
So in other words, you're saying that we should have more pragmatic and experimental approaches to all of these questions as opposed to the ideological approaches that tend to create the legislations that, you know, that cause the mess that we're in, right?
Absolutely, Ian. So you've hit the nail on the head. Right now we have decision makers making important decisions based on anecdotes and rules of thumb. And we need to step back and say, look, we need real empirical evidence. We need real data that will drive informed decision making. And until we have that, all we will be doing is guessing. We'll be guessing what works and why, without the available evidence at hand. So that's exactly what I'm calling for. I'm calling for a data revolution, and that will be led by field experiments in the classroom.
And because, you know, there's a certain amount of meddling going on in education now. A lot of billionaires are getting in on the act. And I spoke recently with Diane Ravitch, who was Deputy Secretary of Education under the first President Bush and was largely responsible for the No Child Left Behind experiments that she's now repudiated. And her complaint was that, you know, public school has been denigrated unnecessarily and that these miracle schools and charter schools that have been cropping up here aren't necessarily the answer. And it would seem that rather than deal with the egos of billionaires, if they had your methodology and their money, we'd be getting somewhere.
You know, given the vast amount of resources that we spend every year in public education, if each time we have a new initiative, if we just had a treatment group and a control group so we would know exactly what that new initiative does, then we would finally learn something about exactly the educational principles that we need to understand to move our test scores and move our children to be better equipped for today's modern world.
Without the disaster of, you know, innovation that is destructive, you know, just for the sake of innovation. Now, there was a recent, I think it was a Pew poll that indicated that over 40% of American households, the woman is now the primary breadwinner. And that's a big change. So you have this amazing change sociologically where women are more and more the breadwinners and heads of households, in effect, yet the glass ceiling is still intact in the big corporations. So there's a disparity there. But some of the research that you've discovered explains what? Why women are less competitive than men?
Yeah, exactly. You know, women have made a tremendous number of gains in the labor market, but your point is exactly spot on. When you look at the best levels or the highest paying jobs in our economy, those jobs are still dominated by men. So as an economist, I step back and say, you know, why is that the case? And people have now come forth arguing that it might be true that women are just less competitively inclined than men. So when there's a promotion to be had or when there's a raise to be had, you know, whereas men will be the first in line, women will actually be much less reserved in chiming in and saying, look, I deserve that promotion or I deserve that pay raise. So then we asked ourselves, you know, if that's true in the Western world, why is that the case? Is it nature or is it nurture? So we literally went to the end of the earth when we went to India and we visited a matrilineal society called the Kasi Society. And that's up in the northern part of India near a very large city called Shillong. So what you have here is a society where women essentially are running the village. If you have wealth that needs to be allocated or inheritance that needs to be passed along, all of the wealth will run through the youngest female in the household. If a family has one boy and one girl, and they can only afford to send one of them to school, they will actually send the little girl to school rather than the little boy. So this is a society where it's just about reverse from what we have in the Western world. Now, what we've done in this society is we've gone and we've run simple experiments. And what we find in this society is that women are actually more competitive than men. In fact, the Kasi women act a lot like American men, and the Kasi men act a lot like American women. So what we argue is that much of the gender difference that we observe in modern economies is because of very important societal influences. Society every day tells us how we should behave and how we should act. And when you look at other societies that give women more of a chance to display their true preferences, what you find is that women are indeed very competitive. It's just that society needs to give them the okay to express those competitive tendencies.
Well, John List, I thank you so much for joining us and for your new book, The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. I thank you.
Ian, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with John List, who is a professor of economics and chairman of the Department of Economics at the University of Chicago. He's been a research associate at the National Bureau of Economics for more than a decade and served as senior economist on the President's Council of Economic Advisors for Environmental Resource Economics. He's the co-author of the new book, just out, The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.